WrestleSpective Radio is not affiliated with World Wrestling Entertainment, TNA Wrestling, Ring of Honor Wrestling, or any other sports entertainment entity or personality.
You're listening to WrestleSpective Radio. Learn to love it.
Hello, and welcome to WrestleSpective Radio. I'm Jason Mann, and with me for the first time is Bill Baconhill. Bill, how you doing?
I'm just fine, Jason. How you doing?
Doing really good. And we're continuing our Macho Main Event series by talking about Hulk Hogan and Randy Savage against Vader and Ric Flair at Slamboree 1995. Ooh. And this was a pretty interesting time in WCW history. I wasn't really watching. I've seen a lot of, you know, old footage and stuff, but you were pretty invested in WCW during this time?
Right, right. And it was really a time when I think they were still really trying to find their legs with Hogan. I don't think they really managed to do a whole lot for a little while. A lot of stuff in this match is kind of a mess. There's a lot going on.
Yeah.
You know, you've got, you know, you mentioned the four principles, but it's not just them. It's Jimmy Hart's out with Hogan and Savage. The Renegade is out.
Yes.
Arn Anderson is there. Angelo Poffo was at ringside, probably one of the very few times I've ever actually seen him on a wrestling show.
Yeah.
The Giant shows up.
Right.
Big Show shows up for a little cameo before he ever wrestled a match.
Yeah.
So there's a lot happening here, and it set off a lot of stuff, and you know, you could see a lot of the early stages of the things they were trying to do later in the year, and it's one of those matches that's just really busy.
Yeah, this is definitely sort of, you know, in sort of a transitional match in some respects. I mean, you've got. You know, it's sort of, you know, building up to the big shows, because you're kind of in the middle of the Hogan and Vader feud that started off, I believe it's at Super Brawl 5 in 1995, so like 3 months before.
It really kicked off at Starrcade, actually.
Okay.
Just after Hogan in the main event at Starrcade fought the Butcher, who was Ed Leslie, Brutus Beefcake. After the match, they did the usual post-match celebration, and Vader and Harley Race, who I don't know where Harley Race was during this match, but I really would have liked to have seen him out there. I think he dropped off with Vader for some reason or left the company. I don't remember.
Yeah, he must have, yeah.
But it was basically just like, let's get the next feud rolling, and you really got the impression at that point that they weren't really invested in Hogan versus the Butcher as a long-term feud. So they all right, let's roll out Vader.
Yeah.
That's what everybody wants to see.
Yeah.
Well, Super Bowl was the first match.
So. Right, that's what I meant. The first match of the feud, which was a really good match. One of my favorite Hogan matches of all time, actually. Yeah. You know, Hogan, I guess Hogan beat Vader in a strap match at
Uncensored.
Uncensored pay-per-view. But he hadn't really pinned. I mean, that feud hadn't really ended yet. The bluff was still to come.
Right.
You know,
a lot of it and a lot of the endings at that time centered around Flair trying to get involved and accidentally screwing over Vader.
Right, right.
Which was sort of the run of the angle. I think the ending to the strap match was Flair got latched into the strap and Hogan dragged Flair to the corner. This is back when you had to slap the corner to win a strap match.
Yeah.
Which I don't think WWE ever. Well, they did it with Eddie Guerrero and JBL a few years ago.
Yeah, yeah. The strap match always kind of has the little bit of the lame ending, you know. I guess it's sort of a way to. Usually, it's sort of a way for the heel to be able to win a match in the feud without really beating the face, kind of.
Right.
Although not in that instance, but
right,
most
exactly.
of the time. yeah, and Flair, of course, had retired at Halloween Havoc 94, so he had been out for 6-7 months. This is, I believe, his actual first match, at least his first televised pay-per-view match back. I think he had done some TV tapings beforehand, but I don't think they'd aired yet because it was for the U.S. title tournament.
Right, I think you're right, actually. I think this was, let's see. Yeah, it would have been, actually. It would have been.
Yeah.
So Flair kept getting involved, and he had just gotten reinstated.
Right.
As they were doing angles with the this was one of the first times they actually showed the WCW Executive Committee,
ooh,
which kept getting tossed around. And what was really interesting was that the person who cast the deciding vote would later go on to play Sonny Ono.
Oh, that's interesting.
And would manage Ultimo Dragon, Yuji Nagata, and a bunch of other guys over the next few years.
Yeah, and would be involved in a major lawsuit that led to Time Warner washing its hands of WCW.
Yeah, pretty much.
So, big discrimination lawsuit. So.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I also, in the accompanying video package beforehand, I love the Hogan Savage Renegade clips, you know, showing them together, the Monster Maniacs, you know?
The Monster Maniacs, up in the big lightning background. And
right. For people who don't know Renegade, he was a pretty blatant, cheap Ultimate Warrior ripoff.
Not a very good one, either.
No. I mean, you know, it's not like you can get a whole lot worse than the Ultimate Warrior, at least when it comes to, you know, kind of in the ring stuff. Mm-hmm. But I mean, he was nearly as bad in the ring and also had no presence and no physique and none of like the attributes that like Ultimate Warrior, you know, brought to the table, so to speak.
And as weird as this is going to sound, one of the things that I really remember about him was that he could not promo, which is a weird thing to say about an Ultimate Warrior impersonator.
Right.
But Warrior would at least go out there and look crazy and say something weird and snort a little bit. And
yeah.
The Renegade kind of sounded like this. It didn't really work.
Yeah.
So, there were just, the poor guy had everything working against him. And this match, actually, he doesn't even wrestle in it, but it's a showcase for how bad he is, too.
Yes. There are several instances of how bad he is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it begins. You mentioned, of course, the Giant. During the intros for Hogan and Savage coming out with Jimmy Hart, they have like, I guess they show some sort of like shadow, which Eric Bischoff mentions. And then later on we actually see him. But at first, yeah, I'm like, oh, what are they leading to here? Thinking, oh yeah, wait, Giant isn't coming to Halloween Havoc, so this is, you know, 5 months away from that. Like, I can't be Giant already. But yeah, they were really building that for a long time before they actually built to that match.
I believe the Giant appeared officially in, you know, and named himself. It might have been Bash at the Beach.
Okay.
He was around for a little while. He didn't officially wrestle till Halloween Havoc, but he would do goofy vignettes with the Dungeon of Doom and things.
Sure. But just, you know, building to that big match. I mean that's a pretty, you know, interesting amount of discipline that they would show in that instance. You know, I guess it's sort of just indicative of the time.
I think one of the things is that they wanted to get him on TV as quickly as possible, but at the same time, you know, he couldn't work a match.
Yeah.
The story with him is, didn't Hogan find him working at a bar or something like that?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it was Hogan, but I think wrestlers found him.
Yeah.
It may have been Hogan, I'm not positive, but
so they find this guy, and you know, he's of course huge, and not just big, he was really cut at the time.
Yeah.
He was, you know, he's gotten really kind of chunky since then, but that's just because he's getting older.
Yeah.
You know, at the time he was really built, he gets built a lot in this time for his agility. He could throw a missile drop kick he did in a couple of matches.
Yeah.
And I vaguely recalling a moonsault at one point. I might be mistaken there.
I don't remember a moonsault, but it's certainly possible. I mean, he was certainly, you know, uncommonly athletic. I mean, he actually turned out to be, you know, for his level of experience, I always thought he was okay in WCW.
Yeah, he did really well. It's just that they just, after a while, just didn't seem to know what to do with him.
Right.
And they sort of did stick him with Lex Luger for a little while, and then put him with the NWO again, and then split him from the NWO, and put him back in the NWO. Probably 5 or 6 times he left and went back in the NWO.
He really did go back and forth, and that didn't really change much in WWE, where he would go back and forth between different factions and different characters for a long time.
How many times has he turned?
Yeah, a lot. I mean, especially in like the 99 to 2002, 3 period. I mean, he turned, you know, once or twice every year. It's been a little more stable since then, but.
Yeah. Now they seem to be kind of consistent with him. Okay, he's a babyface, which I like.
Yeah.
Prefer him at that. He's got a good charisma about him. He's got a good natural. I think he's a good goofball character.
Yeah, I agree. I think he's in the right role based on his you know, based on his experience and his abilities, and he sort of fits the right thing. I mean, I don't think he ever lived up to, you know, the Andre comparisons, but, you know, first of all, who's going to live up to that? And second of all, you know, the business changed so much that you really couldn't do that again.
Yeah. But, you know, he's a good utility player.
Exactly. Yeah.
At this point, he was just a guy in sunglasses and an ugly shirt.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Which 1995 had a lot of ugly shirts. So.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did. And a lot of sleeveless black leather jackets.
Yes.
It was a good time for Arn had one, of course. Brian Pillman had one.
Oh, yeah.
And I think Benoit really started to do a lot of appearances that year.
Yeah.
And of course, Alex Wright was always.
Yes. Das Wunderkind. Yes.
Das Wunderkind.
Yes. Yeah. So. Yeah, I think WCW was really, as you mentioned, 95 was really kind of like, almost like their, like, building year. I can't call it rebuilding year because they'd been down for so long that, you know, it wasn't like they really had anything to rebuild from. But it was really kind of the year where, you know, they were figuring out what to do with Hogan. They were kind of, you know, they added Savage. Like,
right.
It felt like they really went overkill with, you know, bringing in Hogan's buddies and kind of redoing, you know, WWE Light or WWF Light, and they kind of brought in some, you know, more international talent and kind of brought diversity and launched Nitro, and then it kind of forged sort of the mix of the old WCW and the old WWF, and then, you know, a new base of talent into the, you know, well, it led to the 96 through 99, you know, pretty hot period for them.
Right. So. Yeah, this was a feeling out period. This was, I think, a lot of the things that they were doing at the time were emulating a lot of the WWF's booking with Hogan.
Yeah.
One of the things I talked about with Case All Your Fall during our podcast a little while ago was how so much of the booking around Hogan involved building up dragons for him to sell.
Yeah.
And Vader, unfortunately, ended up being one of these. Which I think it was unfortunate because he had such a great history in WCW. He'd been with the company for about 3 or 4 years by this point.
Mm-hmm.
He'd had incredible feuds with Sting, especially, but also also Ron Simmons for a little while. And even with Flair, Starrcade 1993.
Yeah.
One of my favorite Starrcade main events ever. The,
me too.
Flair match in
China. Yeah.
Or is it Greensboro?
I think it was Greensboro.
Flair Country.
Yeah.
And this was before WCW had gone, oh, we're in North Carolina, we'll find a way to humiliate Ric Flair.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
That was Nitro. Oh, we're in North Carolina, how can we make the horsemen look like idiots?
Yes, yes. Yeah, and of course, Vader also Cactus Jack as well, and Sting.
Oh, Cactus. Yeah.
Yeah. And even British Bulldog, you know, they had some decent matches in 93. So.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I think they probably could have done a little more with Vader, but, I mean, he did have, you know, 4 or 5 pretty big matches, including this one with Hogan in that feud. I mean, they feud for a pretty long time. I mean, of the dragons that Hogan had to slay during this period, I think Vader was presented as the biggest one.
And he came out of it okay.
Yeah.
The main reasons he ever lost, he rarely got pinned cleanly by Hogan, even this match.
Right.
Hogan and Savage win, but it's because of shenanigans.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Vader didn't even take the fall. Flair takes the fall. Most of this period, Flair was taking the fall, which is what led to Vader later in the year turned babyface.
Right.
Which was really about all they could have done with him at that point.
Yeah, yeah.
It really was time by the end of 1995 for Vader to try his hand in the WWF, but that's another story.
Mm-hmm. As we said, the Renegade, he doesn't show up until late. Like, everyone does their intros, and then suddenly, like, they have this, like, big... It's almost like a... It wasn't the whole song, but it was like a musical cue, almost. It was... And then, like, suddenly, like, Renegade kind of, like, runs out, sort of doing, not exactly doing the warrior thing, but, you know, pretty close.
Yeah, he sort of flails his arms around a little bit. And you know, he's cut. He's a big guy. He's actually, I think, a little bit bigger than Warrior. But he could move even worse than Warrior.
Yeah. I like that he scares off Flair at ringside, like, you know, Flair. Mm-hmm. Like Flair.
Yeah, he scares off Flair. He scares off Arn, too.
Yeah.
Poor Arn Anderson.
Yeah.
Probably my favorite wrestler of all time.
Oh, really?
I love Arn.
Yeah, Arn's great.
But one thing I really remember is, you know, that early on, and Savage was incredibly over. Savage was getting ridiculous pops.
Yeah.
And I remember at one point, Savage gets on one turnbuckle, and the crowd just goes nuts. And then Renegade jumps on the other turnbuckle, and the crowd just dies.
Yeah.
It was so emblematic of what was going on at that time, because Savage was Savage. He's tremendous. He's one of possibly the best ever.
Yeah, fantastic, and my favorite from, you know, when I was eight. So, you know, one of the best ever, certainly, and you know, and really, you know, Flair. I mean, all these guys are, you know, I mean, maybe not best ever, but these guys are all, you know, tremendous main eventers and, you know, tremendous wrestlers and, you know, tremendous guys. So it's kind of weird that they end up having like what is a pretty lackluster match.
It's not very good. It's not the best showcase for anybody.
Yeah, I believe this is the only time that Vader and Savage ever weren't involved in a match against each other.
It might be.
I looked it up on historywwe.com and WCW results for 95. I didn't see any other. I mean, I guess it's always possible they missed it, but
I can't recall another one. Vader turned babyface shortly after this.
Yeah.
Bash at the Beach was, I think, his last big card as a heel.
I think he and Hogan had a cage match at that show. Yeah. And that was basically the blow-off to the feud.
Yeah, and the next big match that Vader appears in is the August Clash of the Champions, where he fights in a handicap match against Flair and Arn Anderson.
Right.
Sort of the revenge for Flair screwing him over time and time again.
Yeah, yeah.
But you don't get a lot of Savage versus Vader in this match, but there's a little bit where they're tangling in the corner. Hogan's the legal man. Mm-hmm. Vader and Savage really start tearing it up, and Vader shoves Randy Anderson, the referee, aside.
Oh, yeah.
And they just go, and this is great for just a couple minutes. It's, you know, it's a total mess, but it's one of those things, you know, what might have been.
Yeah.
And they were really, I think, even better than Hogan and Vader. I think Vader and Savage would have, you know, hand in glove as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I really do. I just think the way that Savage could be, you just could have that vulnerability and have that and just be able to sell Vader's power and, you know, be able to do, you know, mm-hmm. the bumping. Even in 95, he was still, you know, pretty agile and could do that. I really do think they could have had a great dynamic, you know. Mm-hmm. So.
And that was really Savage's strength here. He's a great partner for Hogan.
Yeah.
I don't think Hogan quite works in this type of match. Hogan and Vader was fine. I don't think Hogan and Flair ever really clicked for me. I can't think of a time where I can recall the definitive Hogan Flair match.
Yeah.
And I could never really figure it out, but I think I saw it in this one. There's a few moments when Hogan has Flair on the corner. Or Flair has Hogan on the corner, actually. And, you know, he's chopping and knocking into him. And Hogan would cheat. Hogan would rake the eyes, and Hogan would gouge at the eyes and things like that. Mm-hmm. And you feel like with something like that, and Flair is a great heel. He's a, you know, he's a coward. He's the dirtiest player in the game. He's not the sort of person that you should have to resort to using those tactics against if you're a guy like Hulk Hogan.
Right.
But it seems like their matches always fell back into that sort of formula where Flair would do something. You know, obviously Flair could bump around for Hogan, which is one of the great assets to have in Hogan. But, you know, there would just be weird moments like that just didn't click for me. And that was one thing I think that hurt this match. I don't mean that, you know, to disparage Hogan. I think that Hogan gets a generally bad rap around, you know, nerds like us.
Right.
But, I don't think Hogan's bad. I just don't think Flair was ever really the right opponent for him, as strange as that is.
Yeah. I mean, I think they had some pretty good matches. And actually, I liked the ones in 99 when Flair was the babyface and Hogan was the heel. Mm-hmm. I thought those were kind of interesting matches. I guess they probably had some in 96 after Hogan turned. I know they had a Clash of the Champions one.
They had a Clash of the Champions match, and then not much else. Flair would feud with, like, Six-Pac and
right.
Kurt Hennig.
Yeah.
You know, Flair would have these weird mid-card feuds. And what I remember about the Kurt Hennig feud was Flair was another guy that they seemed to run out of things to do with them. They, you know, Flair and Hennig had a great blood feud that, you know, stemmed from Hennig turning on the Horsemen at War Games.
Right.
And I don't know if Flair got injured or what happened, but the one who ended up getting the big Starrcade blow-off match was Diamond Dallas Page.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of weird stuff like that.
Yeah. And then Flair came back briefly for the Bret Hart feud, and then
and got into problems with Bischoff.
Yeah, and then he was gone for most of 98. But you're right. Flair was always kind of a guy that they, you know, he would sort of, like, they would turn to him when they needed him, but they would just sort of, especially post-Hogan, they would just, you know, he would do nothing for 5 months, just kind of run around with the Horsemen and have some mid-card stuff, or, you know, mess around with the Dungeon of Doom for a while, or, you know, just stuff like that, you know.
This was, was this before the Dungeon of Doom really kicked into gear? I think they were around.
Yeah.
It seems a little early for them. I don't think they were dungeoning in earnest yet.
No, I mean they were because they were around a little bit when Beefcake turned, I think.
Right.
But
well, that was not the Dungeon of Doom. That was
the Three Faces of Fear.
The Fear, yeah.
Yeah.
Butcher, Sullivan, and the Avalanche.
So basically the precursor to the Dungeon of Doom.
Right. It's ostensibly the same stable, but...
Yeah.
And they would do a lot of the Dungeon of Doom stuff. I remember at Starrcade, there was this really horrible promo with the Butcher out with this Hogan headstone that was just so corny. but that was the kind of stuff they were doing at the time.
Yeah.
A lot of cartoony, over-the-top stuff.
Yeah.
This match... you know, it felt grounded, at least. It was a lot more grounded in reality than a lot of the stuff that was going on. It was just four guys who hated each other. But I think one of the reasons it never quite clicks is because the heels were really outnumbered. They had Arn with them.
Right.
But, you know, Hogan and Savage, they had Renegade. But they also had Jimmy Hart. And
yeah.
Babyface Jimmy Hart is something I was never really able to wrap my head around.
No, not at all.
It doesn't work. He tries to... There's a couple times in the match where he gets on the megaphone and tries to drum up a chant for Hogan.
Yeah.
And it never really takes off. I don't think that, you know... Obviously, later in the year, he'd turn on Hogan. He'd join the Dungeon of Doom.
Mm-hmm.
And you got more traditional Jimmy Hart kind of stuff. But... You know, him with Hogan never quite clicked. I was never quite sure why they did that. But I think that the fact that the babyfaces had a numbers advantage, you know, the Giant was kind of lurking in the background, but he wasn't going to do anything.
No.
The fact that they had a numbers advantage, the fact that every time Arn tried to do something, and Arn interferes a few times in the matches, Renegade was right there.
Right.
You know, stuff like that. And they didn't really use that dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
There was one point that I really liked where Arn trips Hogan or something like that, and Renegade goes after him, and Arn kind of begs off, and he leads him right into Vader. Where that was one of the few times in the match where they really had a good dynamic,
mm-hmm.
where they seemed to take advantage of the personas of the different performers.
Yeah.
But seeing Arn Anderson, the enforcer, beg off like a coward.
Yeah. Yeah.
you know, I watched this match, and then I immediately had to go find Arn Anderson kicking the crap out of babyface Chris Jericho in 1997.
Okay. There you go. That's pretty good. You know,
another good match.
Yeah. You know, we briefly, you mentioned, of course, the Vader, you know, beating Arn and Flair in the handicap match. And of course, that led to a couple of things. Vader ended up getting into a real life fight with Paul Orndorff and leaving WCW right before the Nitro era. And also led to the great Flair versus Arn Anderson feud, with Arn being mad at Flair for not carrying his weight anymore.
Right, right. And that culminated at, it was Fall Brawl.
Yeah, Fall Brawl, yeah.
Because it was the semi-main event to probably the most ridiculous War Games match ever. No.
Ridiculous. Yeah, that was an okay war. I mean, it was a formula, but it was fine. The one that was bad was the big cage, the Uncensored 96.
Uncensored 96. Oh, yeah. I know what you're talking about. You're talking about the Doomsday cage match.
Yeah.
Is that what it was called?
It was with Hogan and Savage basically beating up like every single like 10 heels. Like, it was just ridiculous. Right. Yeah.
Let me see. I'm trying to find the official name of it, but Tower of Doom steel cage match.
Okay, yeah.
Where they bring in Zeus again.
Yes.
And oh god, Jeep Swinson. Solution. Who I thought was Mantar the first time I saw the match. I thought WCW had hired Mantar, and I'm wondering what this guy's doing here. Because he's cut and he's huge, and yeah, it was actually only fairly recently that I learned that was true.
Yeah, it was Flair, Arn, Meng, Barbarian, Lex Luger, Kevin Sullivan, Gangsta, who was Zeus, and the Ultimate Solution, who Jeep Swinson.
It was the final solution for a little while.
Right, yeah, until they got wind of how bad that...
Hey, guys, the Nazis!
Yes, exactly.
Did you know the Nazis?
So, one thing I want to mention is the Eric Bischoff-Bobby Heenan commentary, which I think Tony Schiavone was a better commentator than is historically remembered, particularly... Mm-hmm. Early 90s. Mm-hmm. But I think he and Bobby Heenan had bad chemistry together, that they never mm-hmm. clicked together very well. And I thought Bischoff and Heenan actually did better than I recalled. Like, I never liked the Bischoff, Mongo McMichael, Heenan, the three of them. But Heenan and Bischoff themselves were perfectly fine.
Well, yeah, the problem with the Heenan, Bischoff, McMichael team really was McMichael.
Yeah.
Let's be honest, this is not. I'm actually a bigger Mongo McMichael fan than most people. Mm-hmm. I think he was serviceable as a horseman. You know, he wasn't the greatest. You know, he wasn't Arn Anderson or Brian Pillman or Barry Windham or anything like that. But,
right.
You know, he did his job. He was a big, muscular guy. He could kind of promo in a way. But mostly he could stand around and look tough. And
yeah. And he had the sports credibility and was a famous name, and, you know, so it was fine.
He worked, but he did not work as a babyface commentator, and he did not work calling Bobby Heenan Bobby Disdain.
Right, yeah. He just made, like, he was lame, and then he made Heenan lamer because, like, you know, Heenan really couldn't, like, get too many digs on McMichael because that wouldn't work, even though, you know, Heenan's a lot smarter. So it's just, yeah, that just, that dynamic never clicked.
I think the Bischoff Heenan commentary team does work. I liked it a lot better than I actually remember liking Bischoff as a commentator.
Yeah, me too.
Bischoff's a hype man more than he is a traditional commentator. He didn't call moves or anything.
Right.
He's actually got a lot of Michael Cole on him.
Okay, I was thinking Vince, actually, old Vince.
That too. I can see that. But there was actually one point in the match where Flair knocks Savage over the guardrail, and he says, "That's vintage Ric Flair."
Oh, that's funny.
Just immediately went, "Oh man!"
Yeah.
So he did a good job of hyping the angles, hyping the intensely about hyping Angelo Poffo, even.
Yeah.
That was ridiculous.
And we should mention that Angelo Poffo was there because of it was WCW Hall of Fame inductions. That was Slamboree was for the first 3-4 years.
Slamboree was, it was originally called the Legend Reunion.
Yeah.
And they had the WCW Hall of Fame, and it was different from the WWF Hall of Fame at the time because it drew on the old NWA territories.
Right.
And the WWF Hall of Fame at the time was mostly for WWF guys.
Yeah.
WCW Hall of Fame had like Vern Gagne in it. It had Earl Grace, Nefez. I think Wahoo McDaniel went in that year.
Yeah, 93. And they had a bunch of Legends matches, too.
Yeah. The few years before, did they do anything in that show in 95?
I don't think they had any Legends matches in 95. They did in 9. They did a bunch of them in 93, and I think they had like one in 94. But I think they phased out the matches.
They'd bring out like Tully Blanchard, I recall, had one of the matches. I think Gene Kaniski.
Yeah.
Wrestled once.
Yeah.
They would do things like that. Wahoo McDaniel would come out.
Yeah, they had a couple good ones actually, especially '93. I take that back. Wahoo McDaniel and Dick Murdoch in '95.
Wahoo McDaniel and Dick Murdoch.
Yeah.
Good fight.
Yeah, and
there it is.
It was shown in black and white apparently.
Really?
Yeah, that's interesting.
You're on Wikipedia too.
I am. Yes.
I see it. Interesting. Antonio Inoki went in that year, also in the WWF Hall of Fame. WWE Hall of Fame. Dusty Rhodes, Terry Funk.
Yeah.
Big John Studd.
Yeah. Which, sort of not really an NWA. I mean, I guess he did have some NWA stuff, but he wasn't known for his NWA stuff. He was more.
Yeah, he was obviously best known for his.
Yeah. I think Andre was in it too before. I think Andre went in year one or year two.
Andre was seems like it was one of the first. He came out and did an angle and basically looked like hell and then died.
Yeah.
or was it?
He actually had already died. He was on the 20th anniversary the 20th anniversary Clash 20, the 20th anniversary of them being on TBS before that.
That's right.
Yeah. I don't see him. Well, it doesn't matter. Either way.
Yeah.
We're pretty off track here, but that's okay.
Yeah.
So, that's why Angelo Poffo was there, was because, you know, the Legends thing, you know.
And it was a strange inclusion because, as I recall, wasn't Angelo Poffo blackballed from a lot of the territories?
He was, in the late 70s. Well, I mean, he was blackballed because he ran opposition, I guess. I mean, that was really the reason. I mean, I don't think he had any issues before that I recall. I mean, he was basically just a journeyman wrestler. I know he was on in the 50s. He wrestled some on national TV on the Chicago, the Marigold Arena shows.
Right.
So he had a name. I don't know. I mean, my understanding is he's pretty much just a sort of a journeyman regular wrestler throughout most of his career. I guess known for the sit-up record. You know, he had some sort of like 6,000 sit-ups or something. You know, he had done, I think, during World War II. You know, when he was serving that era. Yeah, he was. Yeah, he was. That's what he was known for. So it was a legitimate record, I believe. So
it was really jarring though to see him out there with like Walker McDaniel.
because Angelo Poffo was like a name you heard, but this would have been other than this, and I think maybe I've seen like an old clip of his. I've barely seen him.
If you even look at the names, this year it's Wahoo McDaniel, Terry Funk, Antonio Inoki, Dusty Rhodes, Gordon Sully, Big John Studd, and Angelo Poffo.
Yes, exactly.
I like the other thing.
Right, exactly.
It's pretty clear that he was there because of Savage. I've heard rumors that this was a condition for Savage to sign with WCW. I don't think that's the case.
Yeah, that seems pretty silly.
Because it doesn't jive with what was going on at the time. It seems to me that I think Savage likely jumped because he wanted to keep wrestling.
Oh yeah.
That seems to be the clearest reason, but I can't imagine why they thought it's interesting. At the end of the match, after it's over, Hogan and Savage, of course, win. For those of you really dying to know, Arn Anderson misses a top rope double axe handle.
Yes.
It hits Flair, and then Hogan hits the leg drop. And, which was really jarring in a match where Hogan had been, you know, Mr. Immortal for a whole lot of the match. It was kind of a strange ending.
Yeah, it was pretty kind of a silly ending, honestly. But...
And then after the match, the heels get their comeuppance. They beat down Hogan, they beat down Savage, and Angelo Poffo comes in the ring, looking not unlike Rocky Johnson at WrestleMania 13.
Yeah,
a slightly different result.
Yeah, significantly older, but you know.
Yes, significantly older. He tries to get between the bad guys and Savage. Arn hits him, Flair unloads on him, Flair puts him in the figure four, and then Savage just kind of lies in the ring and cries over him and says, "Get the ambulance!"
Yeah.
And it's really jarring to see that in an angle related to Randy Savage.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it quite worked.
It was kind of rushed, too.
Yeah, and that's true. That was a lot of it.
Yeah, like it didn't really, you know, you didn't really get a sense. And I guess, you know, it's not like Angelo Poffo is somebody that, you know, anyone would have been invested in other than the fact that he's Randy Savage's dad. So it's not like he was established or, you know, he was just an old guy, you know, kind of a random old guy, you know. So it's just sort of weird. Yeah, and the booking of, I mean, I guess Flair kind of had to eat the pinfall, you know, because, mm-hmm. you know, Hogan beating Vader wouldn't have made sense.
Yeah, it kept with the story.
Yeah. Probably what would have made the most sense would have been Vader beating Hogan, but...
Yeah.
But I guess that's not going to happen, so that's ridiculous.
That's true. And this was, I think, supposed to be sort of a feel-good show. I think that's my opinion.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, and then basically, yeah, I mean, the main angle leads to Savage and Flair at the Great American Bash 95.
Yeah.
Which, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry.
Which leads to which I mean, Angelo gets involved again. I think Flair hits Savage with his cane to beat him at that.
Right. So, which leads to Bash at the Beach and the lifeguard match.
Oh yeah.
I think it was just a lumberjack match with lifeguards. The first Bash at the Beach, for those of you kids who were too young to remember it, the first Bash at the Beach actually took place at the beach.
Yeah. Yeah,
they wrestled on the beach, and it was always really weird when WCW did those outdoor shows. They never quite kicked off. I liked the first. It was originally Hog Wild, later became Road Wild. I did the first Hog Wild because it was insane, basically.
it was kind of a crazy atmosphere. But yeah, the Bash at the Beach show, that was not a particularly good. That atmosphere was not strong. And if I recall correctly, that Flair Savage match was pretty silly.
Mm-hmm.
The Great American Bash match wasn't bad, but
yeah, I'm gonna have to see that one again.
I was years ago that I saw it. Probably like
we should have done that one.
Late 90s. Well, yeah.
Probably a lot better. But,
yeah.
I was in the mood for a mess.
Exactly. Yeah. Although the Flair Savage matches were better when they kind of brought it back, like in '96, when they were kind of trading the title.
That was, and I think they really wanted to get a Flair Savage angle going, because Flair and Savage are two, you know, they're classic opponents. They work great matches with each other. They have a great dynamic. They did in the WWF.
Yeah.
They did in WCW. The Angelo Poffo thing didn't quite work as an angle, but when it involved Elizabeth, which is what the angle of 96 was about.
Yeah.
It was about Elizabeth and woman and Flair and his entourage, you know. Then we had a period where, you know, the horsemen were in full swing. You had Flair and Arn along with Benoit and Brian Pillman. Flair had woman. Arn was actually getting pretty heavily pushed around this time. He pinned Hogan.
Yeah, twice, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, Arn pinned Hogan, Arn pinned, pinned Flair. He's one of the few people who's done that.
Yeah.
So Flair and Savage had this great angle, filled around Elizabeth, really tore up the house show.
This
is when WCW was starting to get out of you know, most of their syndicated shows were in their studio in Universal Studios, but also the place in Atlanta where they filmed.
Center Stage.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You know, most of their shows were centered there. This was around the time when WCW was starting to get out of that hole, was starting to do a lot more house shows. And some of the earliest ones were built around Savage and Flair. You'd go and, you know, Savage and Flair would have a big cage match or something like that, mm-hmm. and it would be tremendous.
Yeah, and that really was turned their business around, you know, their house show business around, from what I understand.
Right. And that was the impetus for, you know, the NWO gets credit for really kick-starting WCW, but it was really Flair Savage. That was the hot angle. That was the best act in any company. Mm-hmm. WWF was still trying to find its footing with Shawn Michaels, which never quite worked.
Yeah.
Not in the way I don't think they wanted it to.
Right.
But Flair Savage could sell out any place in the country. Mm-hmm. And this was at a time I remember, you know, even back then, even in 1995. For those of you who are turning into TNA to see this, Flair just looks awful now. he looks like if you panned him, you could get a box of wallets off of him.
Ouch.
The poor guy. I say this with the utmost love. I love Ric Flair to death. Mm-hmm. But, you know, even in 1995, and that's 16 years ago, people were saying, oh, Flair's too old. The 1993 feud with Vader was centered around, oh, Flair's too old, 18 years ago.
Yeah.
And, I mean, one thing you can say in this match, you know, he's not given a lot to work with, but Flair really goes mm-hmm. in this match. You know, he bumps around for Hogan all over the ring. Mm-hmm. There's a great bit where he does the face-first flop in the aisle way.
Yeah, that was really cool.
After he does the flip over the turnbuckle, Savage whips him into Hogan. Hits him with the big boot on the turnbuckle. He goes on the aisle and he just flops over on his face. And
yeah.
He does the flip from the top rope twice, which to me was an indication that they were probably running out of ideas.
Yeah. They also did the sequence with Flair and Savage where Flair does the chops and then Savage does the jab, like in the corner. Like that. Yeah, it was kind of mm-hmm. a lot of repeating stuff and a lot of just kind of them really doing like their basic spots. Like right. they're no one clear appeared to have a plan to like put together a match that was anything other than just kind of what they normally did, which, you know, was still fun, but mm-hmm. but yeah, like we said, there was a lot going on outside, the stuff with the Giant, just kind of mm-hmm. it just a lot of, I mean, you know, talk about TNA, it just kind of reminded me like a little bit like, oh, you know, this is like TNA or late WCW with like 1,000 things going on at once. Which I guess WCW would have that from time to time, kind of that, just that chaos, you know, that mm-hmm. chaotic feel where everything like in WWE is very controlled and regimented and structured. And mm-hmm. WCW was clearly a much looser, you know, structure, which, you know, I think served them well a lot, but not necessarily this match.
Right. I'll tell you one thing, though, that I noticed about, you mentioned the trading chops and jabs in the corner. The first time that they go to the corner, Flair and Savage do, and it's kind of at a point in the match, you know, Flair doesn't have the heat yet, you know, Savage is still fresh. Flair chops him in the corner, and the crowd does the woo! Mm-hmm. And if you watch it again, Flair stops chopping, and he starts punching.
Okay.
And there are a lot of moments in this match where Flair pushes him in the corner, and you would think he's going to start chopping, but instead, he goes for the punches. And, you know, my theory about that is, and this is probably just me being a huge dork, is that, you know, Flair's such a great heel. He's such a great villain. And I think that he did not want to be cheered at this point.
Yeah.
He wanted the crowd to get behind Savage. There's actually a point later where they do it again. They go to the corner, like you said. And this time, Flair lays in the chops. Mm-hmm. And the reason he can do that is because he's got Savage winded a little bit.
Yeah.
He's not going to rally behind Flair mm-hmm. because Savage has already been beaten down a little bit. You know, it's a subtle thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, that was the kind of stuff that Flair did mm-hmm. when he was at his prime. Flair would do great stuff to get heat with the crowd. Flair would pick out one guy in the crowd. I don't think he did it in this match. And he would just jaw with that guy during the match. Like, shut up, fat boy.
Yeah.
Yeah. He would just do stuff like that. That was just great. Mm-hmm. As far as, you know, drawing heat, making himself a bad guy. And, you know, I don't think ever really disliked Ric Flair. But God, did he make you work to like him.
Mm-hmm.
He was really good at being just completely diabolical, but yet you loved him anyway because he's Ric Flair.
Yeah. I mean, especially at this point, I mean, he was really, it was hard not like, I mean, you know, maybe like at his peak in the 80s when he was just really like arrogant and really, you know, when he was just really, you know, just mm-hmm. absolutely at his cockiest. But yeah, at this point, yeah, Flair is so much fun. You know, it's just mm-hmm. hard to not enjoy him. Yeah. Couple points I just want to talk about the match real quick. Early on with... kind of, there's like the Vader Hogan. They kind of do the lockup and they, you know, push each other back a little bit and kind of start off slow. And then right. Vader pounds him in the corner. Then Hogan kind of gets the thumb to the eye and pounds him a bit and then clotheslines Vader down. And Vader's mask somehow comes off during this. And then Savage follows Vader going to the floor with an axe handle to the floor, which I thought was cool.
Right.
And then, but then a little bit later, they try like the double team on Vader, and then Vader clotheslines them both down. So Vader
that was
kinda,
so great.
Yeah,
that's so Vader.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was really cool. And that's not something you would see normally with the big guys against Hogan and Savage. I mean,
I was thinking about that. I was thinking about how few guys. There aren't a whole lot of wrestlers like Vader anymore. The big guys now, if you look at WWE, are like, you know, they're either guys like Big Show's good, but he works a really different style from Vader.
Yeah.
I think he's underrated, but there's no real big bruiser beat the crap out of you type. Sheamus is maybe the closest thing they've got.
Right.
And, you know, Sheamus is pretty good.
Yeah. Exactly,
but you don't see a lot of this. A lot of this guy who just pounds the crap out of people. TNA tries it from time to time. You know, Matt Morgan was doing that sort of shtick, but he's Matt Morgan.
Yeah.
Abyss does it, but he's Abyss.
Right. Exactly.
That great double clothesline moment where Vader just and he gets all of it. He gets all of it. I felt bad for Savage especially.
Yeah.
After that, one thing that I noticed there was a lot of working over the leg with Hogan at one point.
Yeah.
Which is another thing I don't think you see too much anymore.
Mm-hmm.
A guy just working over a single body part. And you know, I remember thinking, oh, this is great. Flair, you know, he's beaten on the leg. You know, obviously setting up the figure four. Vader tags in and he does he kneels on the leg for a little while just for
right.
stretching, and then he turns it into an ankle lock type move.
Mm-hmm.
Almost we'll call it an ankle lock.
Sure.
Sort of an ankle lock come bust and come half crab type deal.
Yeah.
And you know, it's so great and they're building this up, and then what happens after that? Vader does the suplex, and what's Hogan do?
He no-sells as Vader brags. He turns around, he brags, and Hogan just pops up really quick, and no, no pain at all. Yeah.
Right back up. And that's one of the... That always drove me crazy about Hogan.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those things that really stuck out because they were working the leg. And, you know, and it was, you know, it was kind of a great story that they were telling with it. And then it just ends abruptly.
Yeah, it's one thing if Hogan does that like at the very end, like in the Hulk up and the comeback, and he's finishing that way. I mean, it's one thing to do it at the very end after you've built that up for so long, but mm-hmm. to do it like halfway through the match is just weird.
Well, that was kind of a running thing. Vader and Hogan would kind of have no sell off, so to speak.
Yeah,
where Vader would powerbomb Hogan, you know, the powerbomb that murdered Cactus Jack, and
yeah.
And, you know, Hogan would shoot right up. Hogan would hit the leg drop, and Vader would kick out at one.
Yeah, but that was at least at the end of that match, you know, the Slamboree match. So that, or the...
Uncensored.
Or no, actually...
Super Brawl.
Yeah, Super Brawl match. So, I mean, that was at least, I feel like they built up enough to that, to that, where that was just like, oh, wow. You know, that was just, like, incredible. Like, you know, the two of them doing that. Like, there was something cool about, like, both of them. Just, it set them up kind of as equals rather than as, like, Hogan always being, like, the badass guy, you know? Like,
right.
And that's, in that time it worked. But, yeah, here did not work as well, you know?
And I think it's, again, part of the issue is that, like I said earlier, I don't think Flair and Hogan really click.
Yeah.
And it's for that reason.
Yeah.
Just because Hogan doing stuff like that, you know, it works fine against Vader, but I think the fact that he's in there with Flair, the fact that, you know, the story is they're working over the leg so that Flair can hopefully put on the figure four. Flair doesn't put on the figure four. Hogan puts on the figure four.
Right. Yeah.
Which is... I was thinking about this, Flair going to the top rope twice, and I'm thinking, oh, Rick, does that ever work?
Yeah.
And I thought, and then as I was thinking about it, I was going, come to think of it, how many people really submitted to the figure four?
It doesn't happen that often.
Yeah, even, you know, the biggest emotional matches, you know, I'm thinking Flair versus Vader at... Starcade, even that match, Flair wins with a roll-up.
Right.
After Harley Race comes off the top of it.
Yeah.
I miss WCW so much. Goofy stuff like that, but you just... That just felt... you mentioned that this felt off... A lot of this felt off the cuff.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of this felt improvised. Whereas the WWF seems to always be... Boom, 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 boom. And that's one of the things that I miss a little bit about having a good Southern-style wrestling promotion.
Yeah.
I don't think TNA really fits the bill. They try too hard.
Yeah. TNA is basically... I think of TNA as, like, the modern indie promotion with, like, more famous guys, international TV slot. But basically, like, the main style is very much, like, the 2000s indie style.
Yeah, well, I mean, they bring out Disco Inferno just a couple weeks ago, and Disco Inferno bleeds like a stuck pig on this show.
Yeah.
Like, what? they bring out Disco Inferno as one of these guys from Sting's past.
Yeah.
Because when you think Sting, you think of his hot feud with Disco
Inferno. Exactly, yeah.
Like, what? No. Sure, bring out old Lex Luger.
Yeah, definitely do that.
But that's one of those things that I miss. I think that's a Southern wrestling motif, is having a lot of stuff that feels improvised, that feels off the cuff. I mean, if you think back to, you know, some of the best stuff in Memphis or the stuff in Mid-South and things like that, you know, it feels really unplanned.
It was still fluid, but it was just you didn't feel like you were seeing the same stuff over and over. It seemed like there's more variety, maybe,
right.
You know, I mean, you would see, I mean, obviously everyone has their spots, but I don't know, you just felt like, and you didn't feel like you necessarily knew it was coming, but it wasn't like they did stuff that didn't make sense most of the time. I mean, most of the matches had pretty good psychology and and so forth. Yeah, it was just a different pace, a different set of movements, different moves were emphasized. I mean, it was really, right. You know, it was very different from, you know, what WWE tries to do. And it was, but it was still, I don't know, it was logical, I guess. And I don't know, for whatever reason, it worked most of the time. You know, in the ring, it worked a lot. I mean, I think the in-ring product for WCW outshine WWE almost every year during their, you know, kind of the I guess 89 to 2001, you know, face to face, even if you move it back to like 85 in the Crockett era. I mean, especially really, you know, WWE may have had a couple of years where the in-ring might have been stronger, you know, during the Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels years, but other than that,
well, yeah, there were times when I was just last night watching Survivor Series 1991,
mm-hmm.
with a few other guys, and you know, there are moments on that where 1991 was not a good year business wise for the WWF, but on the other hand, you had Ric Flair around, you had Roddy Piper, Bret Hart, you had a lot of great wrestlers.
Yeah,
and the opening match was actually It's Ted DiBiase, Ric Flair, the Warlord, and the Mountie against Bret Hart, British Bulldog, Roddy Piper, and I want to say Tito Santana, who was El Matador at the time.
Yeah.
And you know, it was a great match with great wrestlers, but it was, again, it was one of those things, and it felt Southern. It felt a little bit Southern style at the time, just because, but it had a great story, you know, it had a great story of, you know, Flair avoiding getting in the ring with Piper, and Piper finally getting his hands on him, which is what everybody was planning for at the time. And I think that's something, too, that you don't see much anymore. You don't see these angles where you're just itching to see guys get their hands on somebody.
Yeah.
It's really what John Cena and Nexus should have been.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you should have been begging for John Cena to finally get his hands on Wade Barrett. But it was just like every week it was happening.
Yeah.
And this, you know, this was, Flair Savage did a lot of this too. You know, there was a lot of, you really want Savage to finally get a hands on Flair. This match, I think, there was a lot of Flair avoiding Hogan.
Yeah.
Until they finally got to the ending. Savage hits the hot tag. Flair's in the ring. Hogan comes in. He does the point and knocks him around a little bit. And then it gets messy.
Right.
They sort of lose it. But, you know, it's that great moment where the crowd finally gets to see the bad guy get his hands on, or the good guy get his hands on the bad guy,
mm-hmm.
which I think it's a lost art.
Yeah, just being like building to that moment, you know, it's really tough. You know, it feels like the art form professional wrestling, a lot of like those little like subtle things like have just sort of been lost, you know, in a way. Mm-hmm. I don't know if maybe the style would just kind of, whether that will be completely gone or whether the style will, you know, maybe evolve back into that a little bit, as, you know, obviously, like in anything, music or any art form, you know, things kind of come back and things kind of return. People, you know, revisit old stuff, but it just feels like, I don't know, some of that little stuff just seems like it's gotten lost.
Right.
One thing, I
don't think this is a good match to showcase it, though.
No, I would not recommend anybody, like, study tapes of this match or anything. I mean,
I'll give it a half a snowflake.
Exactly.
Snowflake. I'm furious with this match. God, Jesus Christ. Go ahead. I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
No, not at all. One cool thing that we have not mentioned yet, and I can't believe we mentioned to now, is that Vader hits a moonsault.
He does. He hits the moonsault. Oh, my God. It's so great.
I don't recall him ever hitting that. I'm sure he did, but I don't recall ever seeing him hit it.
I recall him, he hit it on whatever Ray Traylor was looking at it.
Oh, okay.
Either he hit it on the Boss, the Guardian Angel.
Okay.
Big Bubba, as Dusty Rhodes called him. He'd hit it on him all through their feud, but that was such a stupid feud.
Uh-huh.
It hardly even bears repeating, but.
Yeah,
Vader hits the moonsault on Savage.
Yeah, on Savage, yeah.
Yeah, and he hits the move that would later become the Vader bomb. In the WWE.
Yes.
He hits it once from the middle turnbuckle, and then he tries it again from the top turnbuckle and misses.
Yeah, but I think he did. He actually hit it a second time later. That was the moonsault. He
looked like he was going up for it. He went up for the moonsault. And
yeah.
He did just a beautiful move.
Oh, yeah.
It's so amazing to see a guy. I mean, Vader was, he was thick.
Yes.
He wasn't incredibly tall, but he was just dense, man.
Yeah.
To see a guy, it almost looked, you know, even better than seeing, you know, I remember Sean O'Hare used to pull off moves like that from time to time.
Right.
You know, it was kind of like, okay, well, he's, you know, a little bit gangly, he's got some limbs on him, I can see him doing that. But we'll see a guy who's just kind of
compact.
Thick, compact, yeah. Built like a barrel.
Yeah.
To see Vader do that is, if you've never seen it, this is, you at least get this spot in this match.
Yeah.
So, if you've never seen a Vader moonsault, he hits a very nice one. That's probably the best thing I can say about this match.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. you know, it's, yeah, it is every highlight they've ever, you know, it's, there's nothing wrong with the match other than it's just sort of, it's sort of there, it's sort of lackluster, or, maybe lackluster is a little bit too far. I mean, it has some life, it's plenty fun, but no one does anything that, if you, like, if you're familiar with all these guys, no one does anything you haven't seen, other than the moonsault, I guess, so.
I'll tell you what's really interesting is that this was a big match at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, this will be a Raw main event.
Right.
You take the two big main event angles and you pair them up and you put them in a tag team match.
Mm-hmm.
And that might be, it hasn't aged well, I'll say that. It might have been better at the time. I'm inclined not to think it, but it's interesting that, how the dynamic has changed now to where this at the time, you know, was a big match. It was Flair's first big match. It was, you know, Hogan and Savage together again. They couldn't call on the Mega Powers. So what did we say they were, the Monster Maniacs?
The three of them were the Monster Maniacs. I thought they used the words Mega Powers later. I could have sworn, maybe not, but...
Might have slipped out.
Yeah.
It wasn't three of them. Jimmy Hart was also a Monster Maniac.
Oh, okay, four of them, wow, yeah.
He was maniacal, a monster.
Exactly, yeah.
So, you know, this was a big match at the time, but, you know, nowadays, it feels a little bit like just your standard main event for just a television show.
Yeah, this definitely felt like a TV main event and nothing more, you know, like it should have been, if Nitro had been on during this time, that seems like what it would have been, you know.
Yeah. But I had fun with it. It was nice to see the principles, I'll say that.
Yeah. I mean, it's a decent snapshot in time, that's for sure.
I could watch Savage, Flair, and Vader all day.
Yeah.
Hogan, I'm not the world's biggest Hogan fan, but he brings something to the table.
Yeah, I don't like Hogan much in this era in particular. Mm-hmm. There are eras of Hogan that I enjoy a lot. Mm-hmm. But after this and before this, not so much the 94-95 time, with the exception, big exception of Vader or Hogan, I think, you know, the first one, I think that's, you know, one of the only ones where I really think, you know, Hogan's that fun to watch. But I mean, Hogan could do his match and, you know, and with the right opponent, I mean, you know, he was a lot of fun, so.
Right. Just didn't quite
work here.
Oh, well.
All right. Well, Bill, you want to plug your website and Twitter? Anything else you want to share with our listeners?
Yeah, you guys can follow me on Twitter, Bill_BaconHill. I usually tweet Raw. I occasionally tweet weird memes involving Ezekiel Jackson. I also have a blog that I am planning on updating more often now. I'm actually a school teacher. I teach at a couple of local colleges, and summer's coming up, so I'm going to have some free time, so I will be updating more often. That is TheBaconAtrix, TheBaconAtrix.wordpress.com. I have a blog there. It's not exclusively a wrestling blog. I've gotten the most traffic for my wrestling post, I guess. But, come check it out, and... Yeah, thanks for having me, Jason. I had a good time.
All right, yeah. Thanks a lot, Bill, for being on the show. And everyone,
enjoyed it.
Yeah, no problem. And everyone else, thanks for listening. And we'll be back with more Savage main events and other happenings soon.